There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. Today, my guest is Josh Gillespie, who is the Chief Operating Officer
for the National Reactor Innovation Center.
This is one of those unusual recordings when I am sitting face-to-face with the person I'm interviewing. So, welcome, Josh.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm excited to have you here to talk about what we're doing.
These days, reactor innovation is a big deal. As a matter of fact, it's even making the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, a bunch of other, you know, mainstream publications. Tell us a little bit about what ENRIC is doing to help the process move forward with building and testing new reactors.
Yeah, so it's an exciting time. And like I said, I'm grateful that you're here. I'm grateful that so many others are coming in and you know, discovering and talking about what we're doing. So the National Reactor Innovation Center, or ENRIC, was founded to become the bridge between the government resources, so like the national laboratories, and the commercial sector. And so we've only been in existence, you know, for, you know, 7-8 years. And the whole idea there, like I said, is to bring those capabilities together. That the price for entry for commercial companies is pretty high in the nuclear game. And we recognized that, you know, a number of years ago. But within the government, within the national laboratory system, we have a lot of knowledge, a lot of resources. We have experts in the field. We have a lot of testing capability. And so we said, you know, let's go create an office where we can connect those two and go bridge that gap. And that's what ENRIC is to bridge that gap. Along the way, we identified there was a lot of holes in the process. You know, we didn't have great ways for locations for testing reactors, test beds. We had some holes in the process for trying to obtain authorization, for trying to do different things. And so as we've gone through the last few years, as we've gotten, I'd say, some direction from this current administration, we've gotten and kind of energized the sector. It's just amazing to see the progress we've made and, you know, the money pouring in into these private companies, the number of players and number of companies we're working with. It's a tremendous time to be in this field right now. There's so much happening. And even if you look back a couple of years ago, you know, trying to predict where we are today, you never would have thought that we would be exactly where we're at. It's been so rewarding to be part of this and to be a small part in the cog of what's happening right now. Our office, we like to say the tagline that we want to move at the speed of a startup. You don't hear that a lot from a government program or a government contractor. And the whole purpose is to get the resources at the laboratories moving at that speed. You know, we're not going to sacrifice safety. We're not going to go sacrifice the analysis that we're going to doing. But we're moving to help progress this industry to go meet our aggressive goals.
One of the things that I hear a lot of is people who have always opposed nuclear anyway, complaining about the speed with this movement, says you guys must be eliminating all these safety rules, you're just barreling through. What's really happening?
Well, you know, that's great. So if you look at the industry, right, you look at the code that the NRC has worked to and things, it's been so based in light water reactors. You know, we go back in our history, you know, the Navy did a tremendous amount of work in kind of starting that technology and progressing that. And so the NRC is really based in light water reactors, so pressurized water boiling reactor, things like that. As we have transitioned now to looking at some different types of reactor technologies, you know, we call it new technology, but it's really reformats of technologies that we had in the 1960s and the 1970s, things that the laboratories have actually been working on for decades in the background. So that's kind of the basis there, is we're using technology, and I say new in quotations because technology that we've had for decades. We're now looking at the regulations and the requirements and saying, okay, there's a lot in here that we have added over the decades where we've added multiple review cycles and things that are actually doing the same thing. And so as we have looked to not, you know, I use the word streamline, but actually just right size the reviews, right size what we're doing, actually with the focus of on achieving a result. Many times in the government, our result has been just to do something, but not necessarily get to a defined objective. And I think that's one thing that's different today is the objective is to do it very safe and to do it very effective, but to actually get it done. And I would not say that's always been the case. You know, different administrations have been very supportive of nuclear, but have not necessarily had a defined objective to get to an end point. There wasn't a goal, there wasn't a purpose, there wasn't something to move towards. And without that, it's hard to see progress. And so I'd say what we're doing now is we're moving and we're aligning our resources. We're not cutting out safety. We're not cutting out any, you know, necessary review, but we're actually aligning all of our resources to actually get something done.
How much involvement does NRIC have with the process of the DOE authorization? Do you help the various startups and other entities understand how that process works and help move them along?
Yeah, we actually do. So, you know, we've had the reactor pilot program, which is a result from the executive orders. And, you know, there was a number of companies selected for that. And that was directly selected by DOE. And they worked to, you know, the 1271 authorization process. Those companies, also the majority of them, contracted with NRIC to enable them access to the laboratory system, the Idaho National Laboratory, other laboratories, to go off and get assistance in the development of their safety submittals and assistance in analysis or whatever they needed. Several of those companies chose to site here at INL, and we've been very involved with the process to get them through submittals, through readiness reviews, to get to the point of authorization. You know, you look at some of the companies that have been successful so far with Antares going critical a few weeks ago, right? We partnered with them, you know, hand in hand to enable that success. And I give them all the props in the world, but I think a lot of the reason they were first was because of how closely we worked together. One thing that I'm excited about that we're actually working on right now is a supplemental guide for the 1271 process that we're going to be making available for all reactor developers, which takes the order, and it doesn't re-explain the order, but what it does is it explains certain sections in more detail. It provides lessons learned we got from the reactor pilot program, and points out things that developers would really need to pay attention to, you know, in our experience that we've seen where maybe, you know, things could be done a little bit better or where there were delays in the process. And we're going to be issuing that in a three-part process. The first part is really focused on siting and agreements and kind of the initial process. And we're working on releasing that, you know, here in the near term.
So tell us a little about the facilities that have been used, what they were before they were moved to the reactor pilot program, and how you picked which facility each reactor got to go into.
Yeah. So as we, you know, got the executive orders in you know, May of 25, mm-hmm. We were already working with some developers on things. That resulted in the pilot program coming out, and it kind of set off a series of dominoes of how do we go off and do this? How do we actually go off and achieve this very aggressive goal? So before that, we had been working with Oklo, a great partner of ours, and they are under the pilot program. They're building a facility adjacent to the Materials and Fuels Complex out of the Idaho desert. It's their Aurora Powerhouse, full-scale powerhouse, full-scale model. They're not trying to get to July 4th. They're actually trying to build their actual reactors so they can be like a demonstration to go show off and you know, get contracts. In addition to Oklo, within the MFC area, we've had Antares, which I've talked about. They utilize what we call our RACE facility. It was an older structure that we, you know, we looked around all of MFC and we said, okay, do we have any hazard category 2 facilities? Yeah, we have a bunch. What are being utilized for actual use? Where do we have some gaps? Where do we have some space? And we actually, you know, found quite a few places that we could go off and do these experiments in. And so, you know, the RACE facility is one where Antares was able to go find a home. Deployable energy, we found a home within our NRAD facility where we've got an imaging reactor. There was a great location in there that they could go off and establish a home base to go do their testing. We have ALO, which is building just outside the MFC fence line, which, you know, put up a facility. And they are now working hard towards achieving their initial criticality of their reactor. And then kind of the crowning jewel of Dome, or of NREC right now, is the Dome, the old historic EBR-2 structure. We had worked really hard and diligent to get that that project completed, and we completed it about 12 months ahead of schedule. And that allowed us to bring our partner Radian in and allow them to begin setup. And they are very close to delivering their KDU, their Kaleidos Demonstration Unit reactor, which we'll be demonstrating at some point this year inside the Dome. So, you know, that's just an exciting time where there's so many things happening, so many different developers, and we are still assessing what available space we have within MFC. But beyond that, we're now looking towards our launch pad initiative, which is, I hope we can get into that. So that's going to enable far more resources to be opened up to developers both within INL and outside in the rest of the country.
Well, since you mentioned it, let's go straight into the launch pad so I don't forget that we want to talk about launch pad. Now, as far as I understand, launch pad is the follow-on program for the reactor pilot program and the fuel line pilot program. So it's actually nuclear energy launch pad, as far as I remember. And the Idaho National Lab has dedicated a certain amount of land for people or developers to come in and say, this is my plot, and I'm going to build X here. How much land? How does launch pad work? Is it different from the pilot program?
Yeah, so we're very excited about launch pad. I want to say that first. It's going to be a tremendous opportunity. The launch pad itself is split into two different programs. We have our INL program and our USA program. So I'll talk about INL first. It's about 2,000 acres of land that we've set aside here on within the 890 square miles of the INL, where we're going to, you know, look at it kind of like a subdivision, where, you know, the developer comes in, he surveys the land, he makes sure everything's ready, puts in some roads, puts in some utilities, and then individuals can come in, you know, identify their plot of land that they're going to go build on, bring some plans, and go construct. And so what we're envisioning and actually what we have going on right now is we have our request for applicants live. We have applications due by July 8th. Been overwhelmed by the amount of people that we're expecting to apply. A week ago, we had a due date for notifications for intents to apply. We fully expect over 40 different developers to apply for the Launchpad program. So a tremendous response there. Some of those are going to be for INL. Some of those are going to be for USA. And as we work towards citing these developers wherever, you know, they would like, those that are intending on coming to INL, we'll be citing them within the confines of the laboratory to give them access to some of our unique capabilities, kind of build upon each other as we bring utilities into the area. And the idea is that this is for reactor developers, for fuel fabricators, enrichers, fuel recyclers, the entire ecosystem. And that's a big point, is we're not just focused on reactor development, but focused on the entire industry. Now, the USA program enables a developer to go find a land anywhere in the country. It could be another DOE site, could be state land, could be another piece of federal land. You know, wherever they can obtain an agreement and wherever it's best for their business model, they can go off and site in those locations and still have priority access to the laboratories, priority access for DOE authorizations and reviews. Being within that Launchpad program really sets you apart as a priority and is going to enable you to be a great partner both with NREC, with the laboratory system, and with the Department of Energy.
Will there be security provided, or will each of the Launchpad participants have to build their own fence lines and have their own access control?
Yeah. So for INL, the INL security will still provide the general security in the area. We'll still control security on the INL site. How it works within the individual plots of land, each developer will sign an agreement with DOE. It's called like another transactional authority, an OTA. And within that space, you know, within those acres that they've been allotted, they'll be the prime contractor for that. And so they'll have to go develop their own programs. And so there will be some amount of coordination as far as security and other programs. You know, I don't think everybody wants to go maybe haul away their own trash, as an example, where INL can come in and coordinate with that. And so what we're offering is actually a whole host of services that as they sign their OTA with Department of Energy, they can also sign specific agreements with INL for services that we can provide. And those can be physical services on the site, and those can also be engineering or analysis. It can be different kinds of services that the laboratories can provide. And that's one of the big benefits of the Launchpad INL is the location and the ability to go team with the laboratory directly.
How about fire services? That's one of the things over the whole course of nuclear is having somebody who's trained and understands that they're responding to a fire in a potentially radioactive area, so they need to have that extra layer of training. And obviously, if I was, you know, a resident in, at a subdivision, I would wouldn't expect to have my own fire department.
Yeah, and so where Launchpad INL is located is actually really close to our central facilities area where our main fire station is located. And so INL has several fire stations located throughout the complex. The main fire station is located right there at the central facility, and so that would be part of those services. Now, we have a list of mandatory services that a developer would have to sign on to and a list of optional services. Mm-hmm. So fire would be one of those mandatory services where if you're going to come live on our land, we're going to go provide fire protection.
Right, and you're going to pay for it.
And there's going to be a fee on that associated with that. And that's a key point. You know, the government is not paying for all of this development. This is private capital coming in, and the government just kind of opening up a pathway for the private capital to be used the most efficiently it can. You know, and like to your point, that shouldn't be used to go develop a fire system, right? We have that.
Right.
Let's just go pay a fee so we can go utilize that to provide the adequate coverage.
Now, with that 2,000 acres of land, are things being done to do the characterization that would be used as inputs to, say, an environmental impact assessment, those kinds of things? So, the wind speeds and, you know, the stability and all that stuff. Is that part of what comes with that 2,000 acres of plotted land?
Yeah, exactly. Those are the services and the things that we're going to go do to prepare for developers to come in. And that's why we defined it as a 2,000 acres. Like I said, INL is 890 square miles. We could find a lot of places to go put different companies. But by defining an area, it allows us to go off and survey it, to go do those cultural resource surveys, to go off and define what's on the land, and lay out some initial roadways and lay out some initial utilities, and to be able to go off and service these developers at a much cheaper rate than if they were to go off and go somewhere else.
Yeah, you mentioned power a little bit. Obviously, all the developers are going to need power when they're building. Some of them will need a place for their power to go when they have finished it. If you've got a facility like Oklo, it's a 75 megawatt electric facility. That's something that even the laboratory itself couldn't consume all that electricity.
Yeah. So this is a key point. So for developers that are using the 1271 DOE authorization process, we can't commercialize anything that they're generating. So even if a reactor goes critical and is generating power, that power cannot be used for any commercial purposes. I mean, they can't sell it, they can't utilize it. And so while they're on that authorization process, we can interconnect their facilities with, say, INL power systems to provide power to their facilities and do what's needed. But the big thing is to not just have a demonstration reactor, right? It's to get to commercialization. And that's really our mission, is to get power onto the grid. Mm-hmm. And so you come up with a key point for Oklo, right? They go build that Aurora powerhouse. To get to the point they can put power onto the grid, they need to go past the DOE authorization to an NRC license. Once they have that NRC license, then that's the next challenge is we're not going to utilize any of the DOE infrastructure to go transmit that power. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the early stages with these companies of looking at, okay, how do we then go interconnect them with a utility provider so they can go off and sell? And we fully expect that many of these companies that build within INL are going to want to commercialize their, if they go off and they invest heavily and they go build, say, a fuel fabrication facility, why not try to get to the point of actually selling the fuel that they're fabricating? And so that's going to be the effort after we get through these initial testing periods and testing phases, is getting the NRC licenses to allow them to operate. But there's going to be some growth with that, including, as you pointed out, constructing of power lines and things to go transmit that power.
Yeah, because obviously you have to have some means of getting rid of the power if you're going to generate it. And I've been to places where we generated electricity and stuck it into a water vat just so it could disperse the electricity for the same reasons, couldn't generate commercial power. Mm-hmm. Is there a place between that DOE authorization with no commercial power and a full Part 103 license where you're fully commercialized and can be generating all the power you want and as many, you know, build up different reactors? Is there anything in between where you can actually run your reactor at full power, have some place to put it, but you know you still have to do testing, you have to shut it down and maybe do some inspections and all that stuff?
You know, so really there's those two pathways right now. There's the 1271 authorization and there's the NRC license. You know, NRC has multiple pathways to get to a license. But, you know, as far as to your question, under the authorization, they're going to be able to run full power. They're going to go be able to generate power. They're just going to have to be able to go dissipate that power. And there's different means for doing that. You know, they can dissipate it into water tanks through mechanical means. There's other ways that are going to have to be developed. If we look at the radiant reactor that's going to Dome, we actually have a big heat rejection unit going outside to not necessarily generate electricity, but just to dissipate the heat.
Right. That's pretty easy when it's 3 megawatts. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard if your small modular reactor is 75 megawatts, 150 megawatts, something like that. As you know, you take that heat transfer unit that Radiant has, and I know how big it is, the size mm-hmm. of a shipping container, and say, well, I got to multiply that by 50 or 70 or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes...
Yes, you're exactly right. And that's one of the several challenges we're going to have to work through over the next few years as we navigate how do we most effectively use what we can do under 1271, but how do we also get these companies through the NRC licensing process? Because like I said before, our ultimate goal is not testing. Our ultimate goal is adding power generation to the grid.
Right. Once you've tested all your reactors mm-hmm. here. Now, if a company maybe joins up with another company that has a power consumption demonstration that they need to do or test, say somebody wants to generate hydrogen, mm-hmm. but they need to test all their electrolyzers. They could test all their electrolyzers. Would that be considered a non-commercial use?
You know, adjacent to where we have situated Launchpad, we also have an area called we're calling Proving Grounds. And that's exactly what the Proving Grounds is for, is how do we go off and, you know, do some related applications with either the heat or the electricity. And so as long as we're developing things that are not being commercialized but being tested, mm-hmm. that could be done. And we could find ways to go, you know, cross-test different capabilities. And so, you know, if you're going to say, hey, let's go figure out a way to go off and use this heat or this electricity to go generate hydrogen, for example. Okay, let's go do that in a testing application format, get what we need, and then go get those licenses.
Yeah, because I just have this fundamental, you know, parents of the Depression era babies having the idea of building a real big facility to waste power.
But I'll point out, you know, all we had before was the NRC process, which required, you know, either getting a license before you could build and then getting the license to operate, or trying to get this difficult two-part license, you know, where you a combined license where you could go off and do the whole thing, years and years and years, right? And so...
Well, it's starting in 1970, by the way.
Right, yeah.
Before 1970, there was another process that was in between, mm-hmm. because all the commercial reactors licensed before 1970 were licensed not under Part 103, mm-hmm. but under Part 104, which said that there had not yet demonstrated commercial viability.
And you'll see, since 1970, as you point out, how many big reactors we've built in this country. Right, you could see the challenge, by your point exactly, the challenge we were under to go off and even do anything. And so even though, you know, under 1271 we can't commercialize, wow, what is it doing for us? It's mm-hmm. given us the ability to get like so much further towards that license and to be able to go to the NRC with data in hand, with testing in hand. And while, you know, geez, it would be nice to go off and maybe sell some of these things or get some of the isotopes that are being created or do something, right? It is getting us so much closer to that end goal mm-hmm. than we would ever be without it.
Yeah. So now the Dome facility, the nice big shiny EBR2 mm-hmm. dome, I saw something that said we're actually building on top of EBR2. It's in the basement. Is that true, that the EBR2 is underneath where the current floor is?
Yeah, so when you look at EBR2, it's like you said, a big shiny dome. But what's underground is about a mirror of what you see above ground. So it's more like a pill shape. Those lower levels house support equipment and actually house the reactor vessel. And so in those lower levels is the old reactor vessel for the EBR2 reactor. When that reactor was shut down in the 90s, the fuel was removed, the reactor vessel remained. As EBR2, what do we do with it? What do we do with this facility? It was actually slated for demolition. And so in the 20-teens, we actually filled in those lower levels with cement and grout, completely filled it up in preparation to demolish the structure. And so, that reactor vessel is still sitting underground, but completely encapsulated. And so the radiant reactor experiment that we're going to be doing is actually going to be sitting literally on top of the reactor vessel. So it's new, new progress being built right upon the history that we had.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And I think that you said the Antares reactor was a race facility?
The race facility, yeah.
And what was that used for?
So it was an old Army test facility that was actually not at the Materials and Fuels Complex. They had it somewhere else out in the Idaho Desert. And years ago, it was picked up and moved and relocated to MFC. And I've never seen a picture of how they did it, mm-hmm. But that's the history of it. Is it was moved there, put on a new foundation, reauthorized. And so we used it for other purposes at MFC for the last number of years, and wasn't being heavily utilized. And it has a pit in there that was a perfect location for the reactor to go.
Yeah, you kind of glossed over the Army facility. Mm-hmm. It was one of my favorite reactors because I've always been a fan of gas-cooled, mm-hmm. high-temperature, direct cycle, direct Brayton cycle. It was the ML1, was mm-hmm. it?
It was.
The facility. So.
Yeah, and that goes back to my point of we've been doing this stuff for a long time, and when we talk about like gas-cooled reactors and other things like that, this isn't something that is like, somebody last week, in a laboratory came up with. This mm-hmm. is something that we as a nation have been working on for a long time. We've just finally reached the point that we can go off and commercialize it.
Yeah. Well, I like to remind people, just because it's something that we invented a long time ago, it doesn't mm-hmm. mean it's not something you need to keep building and testing. Toyota is still building and testing mm-hmm. internal combustion engines, and Henry Ford built internal combustion engines. And so did the Wright brothers back in mm-hmm. 1900. So that's 125 years worth of refining the internal combustion engine. So we've got a long way to go to refine our gas-cooled or sodium-cooled. Or you guys never did the molten salt. That was not an INL thing.
We haven't had a molten salt reactor, but we are. We have a lot of molten salt capability. We have a lot of research in that area.
Yeah. I know that there's a lot of molten salts uses heat transfer fluids, but not mm-hmm. not necessarily as reactor fuels.
Yeah, we are working with some partners on that, though, that are moving in that space and trying to finally create a very commercially viable molten salt reactor.
Oh, that's good. Now, there is a facility here that's going to be the MCRE facility. You guys got anything? That's molten chloride reactor experiment.
Mm-hmm.
That. Something that you got, the NREC is involved with?
So that's an INL project to go off and develop that. And again, it's in that molten salt reactor space, which, there's so many promising benefits to a molten salt reactor. We just haven't really, achieved that commercial vision of what it could be. And so that's an INL project. We're excited for what they're doing there. We're not running that project. They're kind of running adjacent, but there is some overlap where we could do some, potential use of some of our test facilities and different things. So that's just one of the other exciting things that INL is doing to progress in that area. And the vision is everything we're doing with an INL becomes open knowledge for everyone, right? This isn't something we're trying to hold on to our intellectual property. This is something we're trying to share mm-hmm. to energize the industry in that sector. We'd love to go see a molten salt reactor take off in that's commercially viable.
Yeah, that's something. And our INL has the history, very wonderful history of having built 52 reactors, but those reactors with a couple of exceptions, were not built by a customer who wanted to have more of them. They were built by the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big difference now, a big philosophy difference between those reactors and what's being built today, because today it's coming in with private. And by the way, we talked about all the money that's flowing. The vast majority of that money is not government money, right?
Right. And if I could add to that, you know, the way I look at it, you know, I like to compare what we're doing to the space industry quite often, right? Because it's something we're all pretty familiar with. So you look, you go back to the 60s, 50s, 60s, right? We got behind. You know, the Soviets got to space first. They sent, a satellite, manned a space. They did all that. We got behind. But the government came in and injected a lot of capital, a lot of resources. We built a very big, broad industry to go not only take people to space, take people to the moon. But then, you know, over time, that capability atrophied. We had the space shuttle program, but we got to the point eventually we couldn't even send our astronauts to space. We had to go back to the Russians to get a ride. To get a ride to space.
They were our Ubers, right?
Right. And so we lost our capability. But how did we regain it to the point that just a few months ago we circled the moon again and we're going back to the moon? What did we do? We got the private sector involved. You know, you had Blue Horizons, you got SpaceX, you got these companies where we provided them land down at NASA. We provided them capabilities, contracts. And what did they do? They drove down the cost of space travel. They increased the ability to go off and achieve so many goals that we wanted to do in space, including returning to the moon. And so how did we do it? It wasn't through big government. It was through enabling the secret of America, which is the private sector, which is the energy and knowledge that we have. And to me, we can beat any country in the world if we just unleash the private sector. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. This is, you know, government, and what Enric's doing is, right, trying to connect the laboratories with the private sector. But ultimately, right, the vision is that we don't need that. The vision is that the private sector can take off and we don't just get to, you know, an adequate, you know, energy market. We get to, you know, we say American energy dominance, where we go off and we can go dominate this sector because of the industry that we have built, not just in reactor space, but in the entire ecosystem, fabrication, enrichment, post-fuel recycling. You know, if we can go dominate in this space, our energy costs will come down. We're going to be able to go do so many more things than we can go do today, because energy is a critical driver in anything that you do. I mean, we all can acknowledge that and all know that.
Sure. But doesn't the government still have a role in, I mean, all the things that INL is doing today for the wide variety of private sector folks and the sharing of knowledge that you guys can do that the private guys aren't going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like that still is never going to disappear.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a role for cooperation between government and private sector.
Oh, I agree with that completely. And I think one of the hidden gems in this country is the national laboratory system. It keeps, you know, the laboratories are working on things decades ahead of when they're actually commercially feasible. And it enables us to go off and achieve grand advancements. And so many countries, most countries around the world, are very jealous of the laboratory system we have in this nation. And so that's not going to go anywhere, right? We're going to continue to make advancements in that sector. I guess what I'm referring to is the need to have so much integration between the government and the private sector instead of the more collaborative environment that I hope we can get to in the coming years.
Yeah. I mean, the private sector can help. You can really determine what kinds of products need to be built,
mm-hmm.
what kinds of products have a market, how they're going to market and all this stuff. But things like what kind of materials are we going to use, they're going to go to the lab and say, what have you been researching for the last 25 years? Have you got anything ready to go for us?
Yeah, but there's other areas like, you know, the administration just released they're going to go issue, low-cost loans for construction. Why are they doing that? Because there's not a lot of money out there, you know, to go off and invest in some of these very large commercial plants. So the government has to go off and finance that. You know, is there a point that we can get to where, you know, the banking system, everything is there and supportive to where the government doesn't have to go off and do those big, big, big investments?
Yeah. I can tell you there's plenty of money out there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that you have is there's not enough low-risk capability. The bankers will lend you plenty of money as long as they can get guaranteed returns.
Right.
When it gets to the point where you've got an industry that has a history of project failures and project interruptions and even bankruptcies of large companies. It's hard to get money. And that's why you need the government to finance some successes.
Exactly.
Then you can go, you know, find the big pools of money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so that's what we're working through, is getting to the point that we can get these reactors deployed, get operational, have success, to where the industry is moving quicker and faster on its own.
Yeah. Hey, you talked a lot about the kind of success the space program has. One of the things that's really interesting to me is how many people I've run across in this advanced reactor sector who are card-carrying members of some of those successful space programs. There's a whole lot of SpaceX folks, for example.
There is. They went off and conquered that sector, and a lot of them said, okay, what's next? Where do I go? Yeah, and a lot of these developers we're working with, they come right from the space industry.
Yeah. Few others that are coming from an industry that may have had a history of not necessarily liking nuclear. The oil and gas industry has got some. I never realized how much manufacturing is involved in the shale revolution. You know, that all those rigs that we've been using to get so much gas out, and the rigs that are used to pressurize and all that, that's all stuff manufactured here in the U.S.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at Texas, which is a leader in that space, right? They are trying desperately to get on board as much as they can with what's going on here. So, you know, two of our companies that we're working with, we've got Last Energy and Atlas Atomics, or Atomic Alchemy, sorry, are down there in Texas. And
Deployable Energy.
And Deployable Energy is headquartered there. But those two specifically are off working towards testing reactors down there in Texas very soon. You know, this year as part of the pilot program. And so Texas, you know, would love to recreate what we're having here at INL right there in Texas. And so, yeah, they're getting on board with all this.
You know, it's an interesting indicator of how much the real world is. You can now get a direct flight from Dallas, Texas to Idaho Falls. That didn't exist not very long ago.
No.
I mean, you had to go to Salt Lake City or Denver to get to Idaho Falls. Now you can go directly from Dallas, Texas.
Yeah. No, it's the amount of people coming here has increased substantially, and it's only going to get more with the launch pad and the development. What's going to happen in this community is going to be big. You know, the laboratory right now is a big driver for the community, and it's only going to grow.
Yeah. Now, let's see. I'm now out of questions. What did I not ask that you'd like to be able to share about where ENRIC is and where it's going?
Yeah, so, you know, to me, as an Idaho resident, I've actually was born here, was raised here. I love living here in Idaho. How proud I am to be working in a place where we're often enabling what's going to be happening, you know, for nation security for years and decades to come. You know, as I look at on the energy landscape, I want my kids to have a secure energy future. Because what does that mean? That enables security in every parts of their life. And so that's what we're trying to enable. And I try to emphasize this with everyone I talk to, is we all are citizens. We all live here. We all want the best. And so what we're trying to do is to make sure that everything we're doing is safe first and foremost. It's clean. But it's going to enable our objectives to be energy independent. And, you know, I look even here in my community, and you probably noticed at night we have a tremendous amount of windmills out in our foothills. You know, electricity doesn't go anywhere here in Idaho. It goes to California. And so we have long transmission lines from Idaho to California to go transmit that to help with their, you know, power portfolio, what they use down there. And, you know, maybe we could do better than that. Maybe we could go place power generation closer to the end user. Maybe we could go create an environment where a city like my own, like Idaho Falls, where we're situated, where we've had a long history of hydroelectric energy. We have power plants along the Snake River. And the generations before us invested in those power plants, which I'm very grateful that they did. It's provided us cheap electricity for many years. But the city's grown. The community's grown. It's going to continue to grow.
But the river hasn't grown.
The river hasn't grown. And we know that water is a scarce resource. And, you know, we're not going to be able to go off and just create new rivers or new reservoirs. And so how do we go off and continue to have cheap energy for the future? And it's not just so our bills are low. It's so that we can go off and have good paying industry, that we can have jobs for our children. We can continue to maintain our quality of life. And so I look at my own community and I go, how can my community go off and keep its power low? Well, we can go, you know, maybe sign on to a coal power plant in Wyoming and, you know, transmit some, you know, power over to here. Maybe not the best solution. We can go off and fill our foothills with windmills, but that's already been done, and that power is going to California. And so what are our options here? How do we go off and we go satisfy our needs? And I'm in a small community in Idaho Falls, but you look to like a big city like Seattle, they have an energy deficit right now where they've actually put a moratorium on data centers, things like that, because they can't get enough power into the city. So what do they do? Do they go build more transmission lines into the city? Do they go build more generation in the city? Mm-hmm. Big questions that have to be answered. And so what we're trying to do is create possible answers. Create answers for these communities, for these towns, for factories, for data centers, for any consumer of electricity anywhere. And as we provide those answers, they're going to get lower cost because we're going to go build at scale. We're going to go build in factories, not on construction sites, which is going to drive down cost. And that's going to enable us as a nation to be more secure. And even beyond that, I'm a citizen of the world. And we look at countries around the world, you know, whether they have a higher quality of living or not, in large measures determined by their access to energy. If they don't have access to electricity, they probably don't live very well. And so as we can provide cheaper electricity closer to an end user, we have the opportunity to go increase the standard of living around the world. And this is the scenario I love to talk about the most is, I said water is a scarce resource. We talk about in the West right now, you know, droughts, different things. The earth is covered in water. Why deep. Can't we use it?
It's deep, by the way.
Yeah. And why can't we use it? Because it costs so much to desalinate, right? You could get water out of there that maybe isn't going to taste the best, but you could go water a field, you could grow crops, you could go do a lot of things. And you look in the Middle East, you look in Africa, you look in the Western United States, lots of places around the world where we could use more water. We have the water, we just need the electricity to go desalinate it. And so that's an example of what could we do if we had the electricity? What could we go innovate? What could we go build? And I'm excited for the future. You know, as we cross this threshold of getting to our goals of 400 gigawatts of nuclear energy on the grid by 2050, as we go off and we work to achieve that and we go put this energy on the grid, what can we go accomplish? And that's what I'm excited most about.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to take a little bit before not end, just a little side. The Middle East does show you what you can do in terms of turning salt water into fresh water, as long as you have abundant, cheap energy.
Right.
They just burn a lot of natural gas to do it. Mm-hmm. But there's 75 desalination plants in around the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, whichever, mm-hmm. whoever you ask, what's the name. But they do it because they have all this gas. It's just kind of a byproduct. And of course, they need the water. So it does allow them to build mm-hmm. a civilization like Dubai, which is incredible, building that kind of city in the desert.
Right.
But they can do it because they had cheap electricity and turn salt water into fresh water.
Yeah. And so if you could do that in other places around the world where maybe they don't have access to the cheap, cheap natural gas because it's just, you know, right underground, what else could we go do as a civilization and as a world?
Yeah. And I do have to challenge you. Desalinated water is really good tasting water. Best water I ever had was on board submarines.
Well, there you go.
All right. Thanks a lot, Josh. It was good talking with you.
Okay. Good talking with you, too.
That was Josh Gillespie, Chief Operating Officer of the National Reactor Innovation Center at the Idaho National Laboratory. This is Rod Adams, host of The Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. I've been providing insights into atomic energy and advocating for better nuclear industry performance and accelerated growth since 1995. I hope you've had the chance to enjoy and learn from many of these posts and podcasts. But that's not all I'm doing. 6 years ago, I entered into a partnership that lets me invest into some of the most exciting young companies in the energy industry. With my partner, Valerie Gardner, we launched Nucleation Capital Fund 1, a non-traditional venture fund to focus on investing into ventures that we believe are well positioned to flourish. Those companies will help us all reduce dangerous dependence on fossil fuels by using ever-increasing amounts of abundant, affordable, dependable, and clean nuclear energy. If you are an accredited investor, you can join us. What makes us non-traditional is that we allow regular people to invest in innovative private ventures in amounts from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We reduce costs and risk by building diversified portfolios using an online venture fund custodian. That custodian can help you determine if you qualify under SEC rules as an accredited investor and helps make our fund accessible and affordable. Investors subscribe at the level they can afford for the number of quarters they prefer. We've made 25 investments, and we continue to see many exciting investment opportunities. If you believe in the long-term prospects of nuclear energy and want to put a portion of your patient investment dollars to work, please reach out, as every quarter we make 1 to 3 investments, but you have to be subscribed to get an allocation. Please visit our website, nucleationcapital.com, where you'll find a wealth of information. That's nucleationcapital, all one word, .com. If the content you find stimulates you to take the next step towards investing, please fill out an investor interest form.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Such a better way today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.